Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hi, folks. Hope you're doing okay, staying sane, staying well. This is our third Tennis Podcast of this week. We think it is the first time we've ever released three tennis podcasts outside of tournament time, which is pretty good going given there's not a tennis tournament in sight at the moment. So we're doing our best to keep you entertained, to keep you abreast of all the breaking news in the tennis world at the moment, of which there is quite a lot, courtesy of Roger Federer et al. We'll be back with more podcasts next week. On Monday, we'll have our worst of tennis podcast predictions show. And if Matt's research teases are anything to go by, I'm in for quite a hammering. But that's for Monday. For today, we've got the entirety of the Pam Shriver interview. You heard a little bit of it in our Tennis Relived show earlier this week when we were talking about the Fed Cup final of the Fed Cup in 1986 in Prague, and Pam's recollections of that experience, her teammate and doubles partner Martina Navratilova returning to her native Czechoslovakia for the first time since defecting to the United States. Well, Pam was fascinating on a whole range of subjects, as you would expect. So we wanted to bring you the whole interview. Just a bit of housekeeping before I leave you with Pam, and that is to correct a pronunciation from our Tennis Relived show earlier in the week when we ran a section of this Pam Shriver interview. It was Frank DeFord, who is the co-author of Pam's book Passing Shots, that we referenced. Frank DeFord was the co-author of that book. So, without further ado, I will leave you with the fascinating and charming Pam Shriver. Here she is in full. Enjoy. Thank you so much for doing this. It's an absolute treat to have you, Pam. In very strange circumstances, obviously, for everybody in the world, not just the tennis world. You're joining us from California, I believe. How are things over there? How's lockdown? How are you coping with the situation and the lack of tennis in all our lives?
Well, I would say overall, I'm really proud of my three teenagers. At a time when teenagers want to distance themselves from their parents, they've accepted what has to be done. I feel like California and the mayor of Los Angeles, you know, we live in Los Angeles, so we've had some leadership both at the state level and at the city level that has been really strong, very consistent, and I think that's one of the reasons why our part of the United States has actually done much better than expected. And I'm pleased that the generation who the order to stay at home is really counterintuitive to what they want. But there's been a lot of acceptance. And I can tell you, as a homeowner, 16 years ago, bought a property with a private tennis court. Our tennis court is one of the reasons why a couple of us in the family have kept better sanity.
How much are you missing professional tennis right now?
Well, You know, I missed Indian Wells because it would have been an easy drive. I missed that one the most. I will tell you, because of the busyness of my home life, regardless of a pandemic or even if I'm just driving my three kids around, and that the level of detail that I would follow the tour from week to week is not as detailed as it would be, say, like when I worked for ESPN at Melbourne and maybe the weeks leading up to Melbourne, so that I knew, you know, what was going on in the lead up tournament. So for me personally, I haven't missed it that much, but we haven't yet gone past one of the tournaments I think would impact us the most, which would be, say, for me, Roland Garros and then Wimbledon. I mean, I thought the tennis world did a great job of leading. I mean, it was a tough call for Indian Wells. I remember that Sunday night when it was called. It took everybody by a little bit by surprise, but it just started the domino effect of what this virus and the effects on the world sports. It just started a series of closures around the world.
Yeah, it's starting to look like a very prescient call, isn't it, by that tournament. Looking at your social media, you look like you've taken the opportunity during lockdown to have the most neatly and cleanly arranged trophy shelf in all of sport, I reckon, Pam.
Yeah, well, one of my first, during lockdown, one of the first things I was thinking, well, what little things can I post? What content would be interesting? And I thought, all right, well, my mantle for tennis fans would be interesting to see the major championship doubles trophies, most of which I won with Martina. There was a U.S. Open with Natasha Zverev, and there was some Fed Cup stuff. There was recognition of our Grand Slam doubles year, as well as the year I got the finals of the U.S. Open in singles at 16. So I thought it was kind of a fun tour. And I guess most of the stuff I posted, that one had the most views. And I think it just shows you how much people want to see one way or another or touch in any way major tennis.
Yeah, absolutely. And all of those things that you just mentioned there, I really want to talk about. First and foremost, your partnership with Martina Navratilova, 74 doubles titles together, including 20 Grand Slams. You're still the most successful women's doubles partnership of all time. What made you such a great partnership, the two of you?
Well, I think there are a lot of things. I think when you look at how we played our singles, the style of play with serve volley back in the 80s, that was kind of, that's how you played doubles back then too. So it was really our singles games translated into being great doubles players naturally. The lefty-righty combination, if you look in tennis history, whether it's Newcomb Roach, whether it's the Bryan twins, whether it's McEnroe-Fleming, there's a lot of great lefty-righty doubles teams. I just think, you know, the choice of who serves, if the sun's tough for a righty, there's just a lot of things that are beneficial to having a lefty-righty. Our personalities, you don't have a partnership that long if your personalities don't gel well. We enjoyed each other. Our senses of humor clicked in. There were a lot of those matches through the years where we would play after Martina was the featured match at night. So we played and we had to wait late night tennis. So if you didn't enjoy each other and our coaches got along well, we obviously we had teams that were much smaller back then. My team was generally just one. Martina was one of the first that brought in teams of more than one. But our teams got along well. And so it just led to, who knew that January 81 would lead to what it ended up leading to.
It was, I think, autumn of 1980 that Martina called you to ask her to be your partner, her partner. What do you remember about that phone call?
Well, I was at Deer Creek Country Club in Deerfield Beach, Florida, having a late practice. And I remember Lee Jackson, longtime referee for the tour. And she came out and, you know, it was years and years before anyone had a cell phone and said, Martina's on the phone. And I mean, whoever I was practicing with, the practice was abandoned. I ran in, got on the phone in the WTA tour office. And, you know, she asked me, she doesn't mix her words or weren't a lot of pleasantries. Just asked me if I had a commitment to a doubles partner for the next year. And I said, no, I did not. I had just, in the U.S. Open just a month prior, I'd gotten to the finals with Betty Stova in Betty Stova's last tournament, and we lost to Billie Jean King and Martinez. I think it was 6-6 or 5-5. And I think that was probably the last indicator that Martina needed, that she was looking for a younger partner, you know, that was starting her career, could play for a period of time. And so it was obvious. I didn't even have to break a commitment, thank God, because if I'd had a commitment to somebody, I mean, that would have been a tough one to pass on, playing doubles with Martina. So I'm glad it worked out that I didn't have a commitment to a partner.
I'll confess to a tip-off here from Mary Carrillo, but she has suggested that I ask you about asking Martina to sign a cocktail napkin to seal to seal your team together forever.
Yeah. Well, we had already been together a long time because we went through a stage. I think springtime of '84, we lost in the Tournament of Champions in Orlando, and then we didn't lose again for over 2 years. So I think it was 109 straight matches. When we hit 100 wins, and it was in Eastbourne, so the tournament director, George Hendon, threw a party for us that night, and we were celebrating to the history of tennis. No one can remember a doubles team ever hitting 100 wins in a row. So I decided to take that moment. I wrote a contract on a paper napkin that says, I, Martina Navratilova, promise always to play doubles with Pam Shriver. And I had a witness line that George Hendon was signed. And as I stood up to give the toast and give the contract to Martina, my head ended up in a lampshade. So it was kind of like, it was funny. And it was, I still have that cocktail napkin somewhere, but it's back in Baltimore, my hometown, collecting dust, but will not be thrown out.
109 matches is truly extraordinary. April 1983 to July 1985. Did you feel invincible as a team?
Well, a lot of those matches, we went into the matches knowing we were going to win them, but there was a handful that were incredibly dicey. And I remember one in particular that was right in the middle. Well, it was about win number 75, and it was in Madison Square Garden. Against our longtime rival. They were generally the number two team behind us for many of those years, Helena Suková and Claudia Kota-Kilsch. And we came down to a tiebreak in the final set. And I remember it was 5-5. It was late in the tiebreak. And whatever, I was returning, and Martina just said, "Return it low, and I'm going to go." And I'm like, "Yes, ma'am." You know, like, you want it. That was great. It was like a plan. Now, of course, then you still have to execute it. But I remember as soon as I hit the return, I'm like, that's going to be a low. It was a good return. She timed her poach perfectly, put it away, and then we won the next point on serve. So that was the hairiest moment. That was when we came within 2 points of losing. But other than that, I don't remember a match where we were like match points down. We won a lot of those matches during that streak in straight sets.
I just watched today the speeches that both you and Martina gave when you were inducted into the Tennis Hall of Fame. And Martina alluded very tantalizingly to some of the chats that you guys had at changeovers, but she didn't give too much detail. Can you share something of what those chats were like at change events?
I went into the International Tennis Hall of Fame with Mats Wilander. And it was an amazing weekend for both of us. And Martina was great to fly into Rhode Island to present me. And, you know, what I remember about our change of ends, I can't say I remember exactly word for word because it's a long time ago, but that would often be the time where if the match was tense, we might speak half of the change of ends about tactics, but we would also know the importance of keeping ourselves light. And maybe there would be something funny that would be said. It could be something funny about something we observed in the crowd, about another player who knows, just something that would make us laugh. Because one of the things that we realized then is a partnership, and I think I realize now in life, whether it's in parenting or when I commentate, that the use of humor at the right time is a great tool. And also, by the way, during a pandemic, the use of humor and laughter is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. Hear, hear. We're going to be looking back this weekend on the Fed Cup of 1986, and it kind of an extraordinary moment in tennis history for a number of reasons. The return of Martina Navratilova to Czechoslovakia, I think, for the first time in nearly 12 years. You and she were part of the USA team that won that title, beating Czechoslovakia in the final. When I say July 1986 and Prague to you, what's sort of the first thing that comes to your mind?
Oh, there's a lot of things, but I'd say the first thing would be the personal tour that Martina gave to Zina, Chrissy, and myself of her home area, the club where she grew up, the home-cooked meal that her mom helped prepare, and just, you know, getting away from the courts and the tournament and really stepping into the life that we had never seen in person, that Martina led, that led up to her defection. And then to realize that we were a part of, at that point in time, the most famous athlete who'd ever defected from their home country and now was going back. And even though 1986, it was still before the Iron Curtain lifted. So there was still, it was still a really bold move. And Martina was not really recognized by the Czechoslovakian Tennis Federation in the way that the other three players were recognized. She was never recognized by name at the tournament, but she was recognized by the crowd in probably some of the most emotional, noisy, enthusiastic crowd noises I've ever heard. So it was interesting. It was sort of like the establishment was blocking saying her name over the PA system to the crowd, but the crowd was just lifting Martina up and, you know, showing their support, applauding, you know, her skill, her talent as being already a multiple major winner, had been number one in the world for a long time leading up to that 86 Fed Cup tie, and to be able to share it with Chrissy, the greatest rivalry in the history of sports, having played 80 times in singles. And so Chrissy was there. And I think Chrissy being beside Martina back in Prague was probably the greatest part of that, that whole thing.
Gosh, there's so much you've just said there that I want to pick up on and get stuck into. She had defected in 1975 and had to write on her visa applications that she was stateless until 1981, when I think she got her United States citizenship. This was the biggest sporting event behind the Iron Curtain in a communist nation outside of the Olympics. It was absolutely huge. I believe she had been denied a visa the year before in 1985. Was it ever in doubt that she would make this return, Martina?
Oh, I think it was in doubt up until probably a week or two beforehand. Like, something could have happened. I mean, if for those of us old enough to remember back to before the Iron Curtain was lifted, I mean, what was really for sure, if you came from a country like the United States, there were a lot of mysteries and unknowns and uncertainties. So I don't think it was until we got there, got to the hotel, sort of had some normalcy of checking in, like other Fed Cup ties, the opening party, that made us, you know, all realize, yeah, this is going to happen. We're going to have an opportunity not just to compete, but hopefully be able to win this Fed Cup tie. And obviously, anything we did that week was really had Martina in mind. It was really in her honor. We were celebrating her as a player, as a champion, her bravery coming back to her homeland, her being able to see her family again in her homeland. I mean, there were so many emotional moments, friends from childhood. It was crazy. I mean, I wish we had iPhones back then and could have recorded more of those behind the scenes moments the way you can now.
Can you remember the flight over? Can you remember what Martina was like on the flight over?
Well, I was playing only doubles there. I wasn't going to play singles. And it was played the week after. I know we spoke earlier in our chat about the International Tennis Hall of Fame. So they had a grass court tournament that was a WTA. It was the the New England stop of the WTA Tour at Newport. So I always wanted to play any tournament on grass. So I got permission from the USTA to play Newport and then fly to Prague. So I flew on my own, and I got there the morning of our first match, which was actually against China. In 1986, China, it was even unusual that China had a team playing in the Fed Cup. This was well before China had players at the highest level. So I arrived, I was the last team member to arrive. So I kind of merged in easily because they were all great friends of mine. But went from clay, from grass courts in Newport to clay in Prague. So for me, it was a little different transition than the other three on the team.
You mentioned this is kind of the huge divergence between the reception that Martina got from the fans and the people, which was just rapturous and so warm, and the reception she got from the Federation and the authorities. Were either of those elements a surprise to you, to Martina, to the team in terms of the reception that she was going to get?
Well, I don't think we were surprised that the public was so, as you say, rapturous and supportive and grateful to be able to see probably the most famous athlete from Czechoslovakia ever. But it did, I think it took us back. You know, we come from the United States, a free country where people are able to, you know, have freedoms that back then they didn't have in communist countries. So, but for us to actually hear the PA announcer say our name, you know, Chris Everett, Zina Garrison, Pam Shriver, and not be able to say the name of Martina Navratilova was just, that was really different for us. And we couldn't believe it. And I'm not sure there was any heads up. I just think it was like, all of a sudden we were like, wait, Martina's known as the player from the United States? That's just crazy. And you can't imagine now in this day and age, but that's what it was back then.
How on earth did you focus on the tennis when all of that was going on? Not just obviously Martina herself, but you, the whole team.
Well, I think it was pretty easy for us because we had obviously a clear goal in mind. We wanted to win the Fed Cup again and win in Prague for Martina. And once you start playing any tennis match anywhere, whether it's center court Wimbledon or a Fed Cup tie or a match in your hometown, you know, once you start, it's tennis and you figure out ways to settle in. And that's what everybody did. And, you know, I, from what I remember, there was just one difficult moment. And Chrissy actually played that Fed Cup with a bit of a knee problem. And Chrissy and Martina were two of the healthiest, most great champions with longevity. And they hardly had injuries. But Chrissy had a bit of a knee tendonitis. I remember she struggled in the match against Raffaella Reggi, I think losing it. So it put, we did have one doubles match where we were at 1-1. But for the most part, we were just too good for everybody, even against Czechoslovakia in the final. So once we got into warm up and first ball, we settled in.
When I think of Martina as a tennis player and watching back some of her matches, she was such a machine on the court at her peak. You know, she just played with such purpose. You know, seeing her play on clay, just being so committed to coming in and playing aggressively. But she's quite an emotional character off the court, isn't she? What was she like emotions wise that week, and what effect did that have on you?
Well, from what I recall, it was one of the greatest jobs she ever did at managing her emotions. But Martina had been through a lot of learning to do that. Okay, so this is 1986. It's 8 years after she won her first major at Wimbledon at 78 over Chrissy. She had been through numerous different relationships. She had had the reporter sort of out her before she was, or she tried to get ahead of it, and she knew she had to come out as a lesbian, and that was in 1981. She had to sort of live through that. She had to live through the defection, getting her citizenship. A lot of her Wimbledon championships, because we all stayed in the village. I remember sometimes there was tumultuous things going on in her life, and she was still able to step out on center court and play great finals, even with personal storms going on around her. So this is one of the things that Martina was able to do. Whatever was happening, whatever emotions that would have seemed maybe overwhelming and could be a distraction, she could compartmentalize. And even though she might have some emotions on the court, they never, or very seldom, especially once she hit her stride in, say, like 1981 through, say, 88, she was very seldom knocked off her goal.
Really interesting, a few minutes ago when you mentioned for you the most special aspect of that tie was Martina and Chrissy being part of the team together and going through that together. They were already great rivals at that time. I think they'd met 69 times at that point, which is just extraordinary. But them also being teammates, and I think there was a very warm moment between them during the opening ceremony, which must have been incredibly emotional for Martina. Can you just sort of expand a little bit more on their relationship and their experience together that week?
Well, I mean, their rivalry, as you mentioned, they were already close to 70 matchups. They'd won major doubles tournaments together. They'd already played on teams, whether it was Fed Cup or Whiteman Cup, which was USA versus Great Britain. They had known each other since the early 70s. So this was maybe 15 years into knowing each other when they ended up being in Prague. And Chrissy knew that it was Martina's week. It was Martina's moment to make history for herself, and Chrissy wasn't going to miss it, even with knee tendonitis. And, you know, it's not easy between Wimbledon and the U.S. Open with everybody's schedule to go to Prague on a clay court, but it was something that Chrissy wouldn't miss. And I think it shows you sort of the loyalty that Chrissy had towards the friendship and the rivalry. And I thought they both handled it great. Two of the greatest champions in the history of women's tennis coming together on the same team at a historic moment. And I thought Chrissy handled it all beautifully.
Did it feel historic at the time, in that moment, being a part of it? Were you aware? Yeah.
Yes, it felt really big. Sometimes you can measure how big it feels by the number of media people around and the number of people who made the trip or could get visas to get in. And there was a lot. There was a lot of extra media there, extra USTA people, ITF. I mean, everyone knew this was not just your normal team competition. It was the most unique tennis team format week ever. And so that's what I remember, is just so many more people. Like the next year it was in Vancouver, Canada. And then 2 years later we won it in Tokyo in what was Chrissy's last match ever after the US Open in 1989. But when I think about all the different Fed Cup matches or Whiteman Cup teams, I mean, and even some Davis Cup matches that I've been able to go to, including the U.S. when they won their last Davis Cup Davis Cup win for the year. This one will, I don't think, ever be repeated as far as not just tennis history, but really, in a way, kind of world history.
Yeah, it's amazing. Martina sealed victory over Hanna Mandlikova in the second singles rubber, but you still played the doubles, and mm-hmm. both countries fielded their strongest teams. You and Martina playing together. Was that always the plan?
I don't remember it not being the plan. I think as long as Martina was healthy and wanted to play, that she was going to play the doubles. And I think probably Martina wouldn't have minded winning 3-0, and it was probably a better chance than if Zina and I played the doubles. Zina and I won a gold medal in 88, so it wasn't like, you know, we didn't know how to win big matches. But the sure thing was to have us, because, again, that was in the middle of – oh, no, it was after we'd lost 85 Wimbledon. So our win streak was over, but still we'd only lost like two or three times in the previous 4 years. So I think Martina was happy to – beat Czechoslovakia 3-0.
What were the celebrations like that evening?
Well, they were pretty special because it was Martina's family, friends, coaches, people she'd known from when she grew up. Obviously, all the regular ITF officials, USTA officials, players. It was pretty good. you know, once again, though, because the establishment, you know what I don't remember in detail enough is to know who actually ran the celebration dinner, whether it was the ITF, so they would have maybe recognized Martina in a different way, or did the ITF need to be considerate and understand where the Czechoslovakian government was in hosting somebody who had defected was a big deal, much less, you know, it's sort of like meeting halfway, didn't make them recognize her by name. I don't know what went on behind the scenes to sort of establish that kind of thing, but I'm sure there was probably a little bit of diplomacy going into it.
Obviously, the Fed Cup finals, the new format of the Fed Cup finals were due to be taking place, well, right now, in Budapest this week. A kind of a return to, albeit not on the scale in terms of number of countries. I think there were 40 countries playing in Prague in 1986, but a return to something more like the format that was played back then. What are your feelings about that new format with that in mind?
Well, I thought there were some great years of the format that we played under in the 70s and 80s, which is one city, one country would host many, many countries. I think, obviously, when I think back to some of the ties that, like the Davis Cup has always known up until this year, and then Fed Cup has known for the last, 15, 20 years, which is two countries play and there's always a partisan crowd. That leads to a lot of excitement. But I feel like if it's the right city and country selected and they celebrate tennis, and this is, I want to say, this is back in the day when people could travel from their home countries to go cheer on the teams, you know, at a city like Vancouver back when I played. I mean, that was Vancouver hosted an amazing Fed Cup the year after Prague. Prague, it was packed. Not one, I don't remember a seat being vacant in any of the matches, especially that, you know, Czechoslovakia could play. So I think it's possible to have incredibly successful Fed Cup weeks with multiple countries in one city, no doubt.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Just a couple of other points I wanted to pick your brains about. You mentioned your Olympic doubles gold with Zina Garrison in Seoul in 1988, which was the year that tennis, of course, returned to the Olympics. We get asked all the time, and when we have interviewees on, particularly obviously an Olympic year as this was supposed to be, about tennis in the Olympics and where it sits within the sport and within the Olympic movement. Is it the pinnacle of the sport, etc., all of those questions. Where does that Olympic gold for you sit among your achievements in your mind?
I'd say top three. I'd say the first major win with Martina, 81 Wimbledon. My U.S. Open singles when I was 16, playing in just my second major, losing to Chris, beating Martina in the semis, losing to Chrissy. And the third one, I'd have to say, would be winning the gold with Zina. And sometimes they're all three like on the same are all three on the same pedestal because, you know, the Olympics, that was no sure thing. Zena and I hadn't played that much together. We'd known each other a long time. But that was a final match against, again, that then that now they were the Czech Republic, I believe. And it was Suková and Novotná. And this match was like, I think it was like 9-7 in the third. And we won it on like our seventh or eighth match point. Zena served it out, but it was like, do sad, do sad. And it was like one of those games where you just have to figure out how two of you can keep breathing. Because we just kept having gold medal point after gold medal point after gold medal point, and we couldn't close it out. And finally we did. And I have pictures. I still have pictures of that win in my house. And Zena and I still, when we see each other, we reminisce about that special time.
Is the gold medal in your on your trophy now very clean
no,
trophy
no.
shelf?
I actually donated it back 2 years after I won it in 1990 when a good friend of mine, Joe Coleman, who was an executive in charge of Philip Morris, helped start women's tennis and the whole women's tennis tour. I gave it to the International Tennis Hall of Fame in his honor the year he was being inducted because I really felt a gold medal in the modern times. Obviously, tennis had been played in the Olympics back, you know, prior to whatever it was, 1940. But this was the first gold medal, unless, you know, Groff had hers. And I'm trying to think on the men's side, was it Metchier won the gold? Anyway, so I just felt it was like the right thing to do, be able to have it on display at a place where a lot of people could see it versus I didn't have kids back then. I didn't, you know, I was just on my own. So it seemed like the right thing. So I don't have it.
That's incredibly generous of you. Just taking you back to 10 years previous to that, 1978 US Open, you reached the final as an amateur. You beat Martina along the way, as it goes. I read that you went back to high school the following Monday.
Yeah.
Is that right? What are your memories of that?
Well, it was it was the start of my senior year. I took some summer courses and I was kind of on an accelerated graduate with minimum number of credits so I could get out on the tour, have like a gap year. But that's why I didn't turn pro yet, is I wasn't sure if I was still maybe going to go to college. So what I remember is losing the finals US Open, which was actually on the Sunday because we had rain on the Friday. So women's semifinal couldn't finish till the Saturday. So that pushed, it was Chrissy and my final at 4, followed by Connors Borg. So that was like a big card for 16-year-old amateur from Baltimore. And then I either took the train or drove back down to Baltimore that night, and I went to school the next day. I'd already missed a few days of my senior year, and the headmaster of the school, Dr. Bill Mules, he made me speak to the entire student body at a school-wide assembly. And, you know, it was a school about maybe 1,000 students from grades kindergarten through 12th grade. But I could speak then Louis Armstrong was the main court, 18,000 people, national television audience on CBS. That was no problem for me. I could make that speech. But to go back to my high school, to my peers, to my, you know, we were going to be the class of 1979, to my teachers, that was a tough one. I remember being embarrassed, but I got through it.
How much did life change for you afterwards? Were you able to go back to being a normal high school kid, or was everything completely different?
Yeah, it was a bit of both. I mean, it was pretty interesting because this was well before, obviously, social media. Things were very different. It was like, here's some things that happened to me with the media. Like my mom and dad both said, okay, you're back. You go into school. There's no more media. You have to go back to being like, get back in your school routine. So I remember People magazine actually showed up at our back door or our front door and knocked on the door. And my mom let them have it and sent them on their way. And then I remember like a couple of days after US Open final, I actually had a black Camaro driving up the school. And this wasn't your normal like school car. So, and the guy rolled down the window and he said, excuse me, do you know where I can find Pam Shriver? And I'm like, I'm looking at the guy thinking, this is Pam Shriver. So he was like from the National Enquirer asking for an interview. And I'm like, I think I answered two questions. And I said, my mom, I'm going to get in big trouble. I can't talk to you. So But anyway, I went to my senior prom. I did the senior skits. I went to graduation. I only played like 4 or 5 tournaments my senior year, and I didn't do very well. It was a combination of, you know, not being a normal pro player, but also having the expectations of being a U.S. Open finalist. I was like 10 or 11 in the world. So I went through a terrible 12 months after I got to that final, hardly won matches. So I can kind of relate the last few years when so many women had done well in a major, either won them or got to a final, and then really couldn't back it up. I get it.
What perspective does that experience give you on young players breaking through at a precociously young age and rising to prominence? Obviously, we've had this extraordinary example in the last year of Coco Gauff doing that, and there's actually been an interesting interview with her come out today in Behind the Racket talking about some of the struggles she's had. You've had an experience like that so few people have. What perspective does that give you on it all?
Well, I think the biggest difference on the plus side for Coco is that she's a total pro right now. I mean, I know she's still limited somewhat, and well, everybody's limited. They can't play any tournaments. But let's say back before the pandemic, it was a little bit of a discussion like, is the age eligibility rule a good thing or a bad thing? But basically, she is behaving as if, and she is a pro. She's collecting prize money, endorsements. She's training. She's got a full team. That was really different back in my situation where I went back into a high school where I wasn't taking it online. I was going to, regular school. I probably maybe had half the practice time as I would have leading into the U.S. Open. But I still felt when I did go out to play, I felt just tons of pressure to like reproduce or play the same I did that U.S. Open final. And I just wasn't, I really wasn't prepared, both prepared from a training standpoint. I wasn't prepared emotionally to back it up. And it took like 18 months before I was comfortable again.
Just final couple of points, jumping around in time a bit here, but you're now obviously hugely established as a broadcaster in tennis. How was that transition for you initially, going from being a professional player to stepping into the broadcasting world?
Well, it's kind of an interesting journey because I had a couple of different transitions. The first time I was ever asked to broadcast was by CBS back in 1981. So I was 19 years of age. 1981, they didn't have Mary Carrillo yet as a full-time. They didn't have any full-time female commentators. So what CBS would do is they had a small group of guest female commentators like Virginia Wade, Billie Jean King, and then they kind of liked, I think they liked what they saw from me in 78 and how I carried myself with the media. So they asked me, and I took the opportunity. I said, yes, I would do it. So that was 1981. I did a lot of U.S. Opens in the 80s. After I would say lose, or if I had a day where I didn't have a match, they'd say, will you come in and will you be in the booth for Martina's match or a certain match? I'd said, sure. So I took advantage of that opportunity back in the early 80s. Then flash ahead to 1990, which was I lost early at the Australian Open, and then ESPN asked me if I would work as a courtside reporter and an outside court commentator for the rest of the tournament, and I said yes. So that started my relationship with ESPN, and I've worked every year for them, either part-time, obviously, when I was playing. I didn't retire till 97. And then the time where I really became my primary career was when I retired from playing professional tennis, which was February 97. It's been great. I've loved the connection still, especially to major tennis. ESPN has 3 of the 4 majors from first ball to last. They're the worldwide leader in sports. We have a great team, from Chris Everett to the McEnroe brothers to Chris Fowler, McKendry, Darren Cahill, Brad Gilbert. I mean, I'm going to forget some people, but we have just a knowledgeable, fun Mary Jo Fernandez and I've worked together, Cliff Drysdale. Just we have an amazing group of people at ESPN, and obviously we're all longing to get back together like everybody else.
Adrenaline-wise, how does broadcasting compare to playing?
Well, it's interesting.
Does it even come close?
Yeah. Well, not really, but sort of. Like when you're in the middle of calling an incredibly tight match, your adrenaline runs a little bit from your memory of having played them. Like, I think my adrenaline, or anybody who's played at a high level, their adrenaline will run differently at 5-all in the third set than, say, somebody who's a professional broadcaster who's never actually been at 5-all in the third set at Center Court Wimbledon. So what you have to, and what I've learned to do, I think, through maturity of my broadcasting career is when the adrenaline kicks up, you have a lot of energy. And one way you can let out your energy is by talking. But sometimes, most times, when your energy is at its highest is when you should be at your quietest. So you have to be very, it's counterintuitive, but you have to be really disciplined and measured and maybe find a different way of letting out the energy. Like sometimes I'll stand up in the booth. There's been times where Chrissy and I have worked together on a match. I remember at US Open with Taylor Townsend at 6-all in the final set. We like held hands through the tiebreak. It was a combination of just like a place to have our, we were like squeezing our hands partially so we just didn't start talking when we had so much adrenaline and interest and excitement in this match that we were watching. So I don't know. It's fun to see tennis history written, whether you're playing in it or whether you like to be able to see the history that's been written the last 10 years in tennis has been extraordinary.
So interesting. Look, none of us are experts on the current situation that we're seeing. Everybody's in totally uncharted waters and seeing it unfold before our eyes. But how optimistic do you feel about seeing tennis again this year?
Well, you know, there's been times where I'm thinking, how can it? Because we have a global sport with people coming from all parts of the world. How can it happen? It certainly can't happen in front of crowds that we've had in the past at big tournaments. It's going to have to be played in front of either nobody or practicing social distance somehow. It has to be done in safe ways. I've seen certain models where players fly to an area of the world. Let's say it's the United States 2 weeks before the Open, but they have to quarantine for a certain period of time, still figuring out how to practice under quarantine situations, all stay at the, similar hotel, same hotel, whatever it is. They're going to have different rules during this pandemic if it happens at all. There is a chance, just like the way major colleges and universities are saying, we can't safely bring students back to a campus, have them dine together, room together, dormitories, classrooms. We can't do this from people all, because universities have people come from all over the globe. So there's a part of me that just feels it can't happen safely until there's an inoculation, until there's better testing and everything that the doctors have been talking about. But I do think some smart people, including like obviously Tennis Australia, who are lucky enough to get this thing just in the nick of time. Because I remember I was in Melbourne, second week of Melbourne this year, when I heard about the virus coming out of Wuhan. They just got theirs in and they're already trying to figure out, have models to how you can hold an Australian Open in January of next year under these circumstances. So I think if I were a business person in charge of, say, the USTA, obviously, Wimbledon's made their decision. They had great insurance. You know, you'd have to come up with safe models of how it could be done and then see if the Tennis Unity, which I love the organizations, how they've gotten together, taking the French aside. I love the unity that I've seen. I think there's going to be some really good things come out of this on the other side. I like the way the ATP and the WTA are more unified now than ever. So let's celebrate what's going to happen, whether or not it's going to happen in 6 months, 9 months, 18 months. I think tennis is in a strong situation coming out of it, but we're going to have some pain in the meantime.
So you believe that unity that we're seeing is something that could last?
Yes, it certainly should last. And if it doesn't, then shame on the leaders of today. I think we have enough new leaders. I think the new leadership of the ATP Tour, new leadership at the USTA. I think Steve Simon at the WTA has always been a willing partner. I think everybody realizes everybody's had to come together. This has been a major trauma that is playing out everywhere on the planet. And I mean, unless you were alive in 1917, you don't understand this. I mean, 9/11 was something similar, but really different. Just in the amount of trauma people say in the U.S. especially felt, but it was worldwide as well, 9/11. But this is really different because it's your health and it's there's so many unknowns. And, you know, we have to figure out the new way of doing business during a global pandemic and then after the global pandemic.
How do you feel about tennis behind closed doors without crowds?
Well, listen, people, the television audience is never been bigger. I mean, people are sitting at home waiting for great content. So I do think tennis is a sport, especially singles. It is a sport that's actually built for play during a global pandemic. I think team sports are going to be actually have many more challenges. Because if one member of the team gets it, then the whole it has to shut down, like we saw with the NBA. But, you know, I just think in singles, if somebody gets it, I don't think the whole tournament cancels. I think that player, and then you do the contact tracing. Doubles is kind of interesting because there's physical contact. You know, there's close contact. So I don't know if doubles is the same. Maybe doubles is made up of just singles players during the pandemic. I don't know. I know I'm saying some things that doubles players would be horrified, or maybe you have separate doubles tournaments from singles. I don't know, but there's got to be a lot of people coming up with some ideas behind closed doors that could possibly float.
Final question for you, Pam. I realize it's a tough one to end on because it's asking you to look into the future, which I know is so uncertain at the moment, but everybody is constantly being asked who are going to be the winners and who are going to be the losers from this. You know, Serena, Federer, we've got a lot of aging greats in the game at the moment and a lot of exciting young players that are injured, for example. Who do you see as the, you know, obviously the virus and the serious stuff that's going on aside, you know, there are no big picture winners, but in tennis terms, who do you see as the winners and losers?
Well, first off, obviously, timing-wise, late in careers like Federer and Serena, missing majors does not help their chase to history. But you can never, ever look at the of Federer and Serena and ever say that they're not winners. They're winners, regardless of if their career, if they happen to retire during the global pandemic, does you know whatever they come to terms with, they're winners and will always be seen as great winners. But obviously, they have a lot to lose during this period, but so does someone like Coco Gauff, who had some momentum, is on the way up. Sophia Kennan, I feel for her, having won the last major, got to four in the world, stopped her momentum and track. So, but I really think the winners are going to be people who handle it mentally the best. They can also look at it as an opportunity to totally rest their bodies from years of training. A lot of these players, you know, this is, look at it as a gift. Look at the gratitude of like having everybody on forced rest, rest and recover and then train and be prepared. And if you're mentally going to hang on to what you've lost, then you're going to come out not as strong as the person who looks at the things they're gaining by having the rest time, rebuilding, maybe think of their mental strength and how they can come out and be a better player. The pause will do some careers good. And obviously some people are going to lose some opportunities.
Pam, that's absolutely fascinating. It's been a real treat to chat to you and pick your brains on so many subjects. It really has. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, Catherine, thank you for having me. All the best. Stay safe. Stay home.
Yeah, likewise, Pam. Best to you and yours. It's really been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.